from the Skyline Studios, high above Columbus and Wacker Drive. This is Anna DeVlantis. How's your Monday going? I'm looking out right now over the Chicago River, facing the lake from our studios here, the Skyline Studios, the Navy Pier, looking sort of that way. And it is a sea of gray here in Chicago downtown right now. And I guess that's kind of what we're accustomed to this time of year. But the good news today is that we've got the warmth, because we're not going to have the warmth over the next couple of days. As you just heard at the top of the hour, we've got a bit of a cold front moving in. So we've got that to look forward to. Ji Suki is here with us still in the studio after her Wintrust business lunch. She's the new host, and good job today.
Well, thank you so much.
And I know you were lucky that you're here. And when I say that, we're lucky that you're here because you just went on this amazing road trip.
I did. Well, it's a little more complicated than that.
You went to North Carolina?
I did. So I grew up in North Carolina, and my mother lives in North Carolina, and I decided to, for Thanksgiving, drive 12 hours straight to make it home in time to have Thanksgiving dinner with her. And then the very next day, I put her in the car, and we drove 12 hours straight back to Chicago.
What was that like, Gene? The 12-hour drive with mom?
Yeah, well, you know what?
12 hours is a long time with any family member.
Yes, and I love my mother dearly. I am her only child, and so we are extraordinarily close, and she's one of those moms that worked three jobs, so that way I could have violin lessons growing up, so I will forever be indebted to her.
Very
besides
grateful.
The fact that she pushed me out into the world, you know, and did all that.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's the right attitude.
Yes, but she is someone that loves to talk, and she doesn't know how to tell a short story. I guess that's where I get it from. But I mean, when I tell you she doesn't know how to tell a short story, I mean that she tells stories in real time. So if she's going to tell you about how she made a pumpkin pie to take to a party,
that story takes a long time.
It's going to take 2 hours because that's how long it took to take to make the pumpkin pie. And she's always passive aggressive and angry with me that I don't take the time to talk to her on the phone very much, because it takes hours to talk to her on the phone. So this was her gift. 12 straight hours of my undivided attention so that she could talk to me nonstop.
I know they say around the holidays is a good time to set boundaries with your relatives. Were you good at setting the boundaries with mom? Mom, I really don't need any more of the pie story. Or maybe you're just like, hey, this is my mom.
No.
I'm spending valuable time with her.
No, and you know what else she loves to do? She loves to tell me about every single person in her life, friends, friends of friends, friends of friends of friends, that I don't even know, have no context to even know, and tell me about what sort of health issue that they're undergoing.
She's at that age. My mom is too. I know. That concerns them.
I'm so depressed.
Concerns them. All right, we're going to, G, I want you to weigh in on this because I want to share what's coming up on the show, but then I got to get to this conversation. And if you're in the restaurant industry, if you're a server, if you're in any way connected to it, we want to hear from you, 312-981-7200, because there's this post that happened over the weekend on Twitter. And typically on Twitter, I don't really go there to find legitimate conversations, nice back and forth, and learn something. It's usually vitriol and polarization and people going at each other. But this really made me think, because it was one post about a restaurant worker, a server, who got no tip. She posted it online, and the reaction to it was not what I expected. So the question is it ever okay not to tip your server? Is that ever okay? Now, I guess horrible service, just completely horrible. I suppose I get that. But in this case, it was not about horrible service. It was about where the person was coming from and their financial situation. So we want to get to that. But coming up on the show, did you see this? It happened Friday night, so I think a lot of people missed this. Mayor Lightfoot was questioning presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg over the weekend. It was an event in Iowa. She was on the stage. She was asking questions kind of reporter style. And usually it kind of is a softball situation in those scenarios. But in this case, it didn't go as you might think. It didn't go as these things normally go. She pressed him really hard to disclose something about himself that she's saying he has not yet disclosed, and he needs to disclose if he's running for president. So Shia Kappas from Politico will be here. She writes one of the most comprehensive morning email blogs that tells you everything you know in local politics. And so she's got that and a number of other things going on in local politics, including the local billionaire donors to Joe Biden. A bunch of local really wealthy people donating to Joe Biden. She's going to talk about that. Also, it's Money Monday, so your personal finance questions answered. David Hochberg and Ray Kaplan will be here to answer some of those questions, save you some money, some new things about student debt and debt overall, refinancing. They've got those questions for sure. They've got you covered. And then maybe you saw those headlines out of London banning Uber. City officials yanked their license for Uber over the specific security concern. It had to do with drivers sharing their profiles. Is it happening here? There is a local rideshare expert who's actually quoted in a number of the articles that appeared around the world, and he says, yes, it absolutely is happening here in Chicago. We're going to ask him, how common is it? He'll be here with that and more on some of the other ride-sharing news that has popped, because we saw some other things pop last week. Here's the question, though, as we head to the break here, because I want to hear from you. The Post that started this conversation about tipping at restaurants, it was a server shared a signed receipt. She received, and she put it on Twitter, she posted. It was from a diner who, one, paid for the meal, signed the receipt, and then left this note. And the note said, tell me what you think of this. Sorry, no tip. Christmas is coming with three kids, but you're great. Smiley face. I thought that part was interesting. P.S. Don't have kids. You'll save money. So left no tip and said, the reason isn't because I didn't have great service. I had great service. It was because, you know, I'm saving money for the holidays. Now, the server replies, this is trash. Everybody should know you don't go out to eat if you can't afford a tip, no matter the reason. When you choose to dine out, I always thought tipping was just, it was part of it. That's built into your meal. Even, you know, general service, generally good service, you tip 20%. That's what I always thought.
Well, what about the server? If she doesn't get tipped, maybe she can't buy presents for her kids.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it goes. I was surprised, though, how many servers and people in the restaurant industry who kind of said, you know, it's okay with it. They're okay with it.
That's surprising to me because, you know, in many states, restaurants don't have to abide by the federal minimum wage. So really the way...
Most states, I think. You don't right. You get 40% of what the regular minimum wage is. So servers
right.
rely on
absolutely
tips in order to pay the bills, right? That's what you would think. It's just part of dining out.
It is. And you should make sure to incorporate that into your budget if you do plan on dining out.
Yeah. So more of that. We'd like to get your comments. 312-981-7200. Is it okay ever to not leave a tip? If you're in the restaurant industry, would you understand that? More to come here on WGN Radio. You want to get to your calls and your texts about this server getting a note on the receipt, on the signed receipt. Sorry, no tip. Christmas coming with three kids. So you're great, smiley face, but I don't, you know, just don't have kids. You'll save you money. But basically communicating to the server, I can't afford the tip. We have Matt. You're on the line. You've been a server, or you were a server over 20 years. Are you currently in the industry?
Currently, yes.
All right. Yep. So how do you read this right away? Are you like, oh, wow. Totally wrong? What do you think?
I can a little bit of both sides on it. I mean, it's definitely happened before. I've never gotten the note before. But you kind of expect it. You expect a great tip sometimes, sometimes no tip, sometimes a less than adequate tip. So you're kind of used to that. And we in the industry kind of budget for that, too. Some of us take it harder than others, you know, as far as taking it personally. I think leaving the note maybe was a little, maybe too much. Maybe they just, you know,
it's like
no
rubbing
tip,
it
no,
in.
Yeah, no explanation really needed. I've done it before. I've, you know, weighed on a lot of veterans and seniors and stuff. And sometimes you feel like I'm gonna buy this guy's lunch or something. He's a veteran. He's done a lot for his country.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe a little bit of charity and I don't know. I've seen it both ways. But yes, you know, we do take care of, I support my family
right.
on my tips, you know. And
right.
So yeah, it definitely, it cuts both ways.
Matt, let me ask you this. Around the holidays, would you find people are more generous? Or would you find you see, maybe it depends on the restaurant, but you find shoppers are more on a budget because we're all trying to, we have, you know, we're buying gifts and there's a huge outlay of cash at this time of year. Do you find,
mm-hmm.
what's your take on how people act in terms of tipping servers this time of year?
I've seen it all. I've seen, you know, here's a $50 tip, Merry Christmas, like we just talked about, no tip. I've also seen people's generosity. You know, they come in and they say, I'm going to pay for that couple. I want to take their bill. You know, it's my Christmas gift. I waited on a couple a week ago, and they say they go out in the month of December, and every week they go out to eat, and they pay for someone's dinner every night, every week in December. So they do it five times, and that's their gift.
So tipped workers in Illinois right now make $4.95 an hour. In Chicago, it's higher, $6.40.
Mm-hmm.
That is, so you rely on your tips to fill
Absolutely.
That out. This is how you pay for gifts for your family, too.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to remember, too, that usually servers don't get health insurance, vacation, or any type of paid sick leave, mostly.
Right. I work 6 days a week.
That's
my choice. So, you know, it pays the bills. I'm very happy doing it. I like people. I enjoy serving them.
Mm-hmm.
So and you get the good and the bad.
And you've helped out other people, too. So good for you. Thank you. Thank you for weighing in on this, Matt. We appreciate it. Merry Christmas and tip them well. You know, this is an interesting couple of interesting comments. If you can't afford a tip, go to a cafeteria or go to a drive-thru. Rude move. Always tip your servers. That is part of their income. I agree with you. If you can't afford the tip, then don't go out to eat. Same goes for any other service or delivery guy, even like Peapod, that kind of thing. Make sure that those guys get tipped, or women too.
The other thing too is if you think you're giving your server the tip and they're getting all of the tip, that's not always necessarily true. A lot of restaurants pool tips and then that's divided. There's been a big discussion about front of house versus back of house and creating equity, pay equity there as well. So,
and you also have to tip out your bar sometimes and the guys who bring the food to the table for you. That
right.
is part of it, no matter what. Even if you don't get big tips at the end of the day,
so,
you still have to split that money.
Mm-hmm.
Holiday giving idea. I transfer all my charitable giving money to cash, then spend the month of December over tipping people. You wouldn't believe how much it means and the reactions I get when I do that. Good for you.
I don't even tip badly. Well, I always tip even if it's horrific service. I mean, I think...
Me too.
Shia Kappos is here. She's part of our next segment, but she's weighing in on this as well. I think that my mom used to be a server and she actually relied on those wages. I've done it as a side gig before, but my mom relied on it. And she is the best tipper ever because I think anyone who's ever done that job would... appreciates it for what it is.
They're on their feet all day. They're having to deal with so many, a range of people and personalities. It's so hard, you know?
How difficult it is to deal with people.
People.
I mean, it is. People. I love you. I love you, people. But people, we are, including myself in this, we are hard to deal with.
This is interesting, though. This is what I kept seeing over and over, which is why it was so startling to me. 773, it's the restaurant industry. You take the good with the bad. You have to deal with it. Did she show her great tips as much as she complained about this one? So that was the reaction I got. I talked to a friend over the weekend. He owns a small restaurant, and he said that that's kind of how he looks at it. Just like, all right, you know what? Give her a pass. She's got kids. It's the holidays. And I thought, as a non-server, it just maybe was more shocking to me that kind of thing would happen.
Because maybe she has kids who ordered food and she wasn't expecting it and didn't want to say no, and suddenly the bill is higher than she thought. Mm-hmm. And
I think she should have handcrafted a little gift and then left it instead of a cash.
She left a nice
right?
note, and
maybe
I don't know if that's good or bad.
Yeah, instead of the note, she should have left a handcrafted ornament that she created.
For like a little bracelet or something?
See, that would have been cost effective.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd appreciate this much. If you can afford to eat out, you can have a few bucks for a tip. It's not going to break you. From the 779. My mom was a single mom for several years, 847, raising three kids. Going to McDonald's was a retreat because we couldn't afford it,
mm-hmm.
let alone a sit-down restaurant that requires a tip. So her point, you know, is just that, look, you don't go out. You just don't go out if you don't have it.
I think you have to think about it as part of the whole entire cost of the meal. And who knows what was going on with this particular mom. Maybe, like you said, she showed up and didn't have enough cash in her wallet, and that's understandable. There could be a story behind what happened with her, and there could be stories behind why sometimes, a server might give you the worst service on the planet. Who knows what's happening in their lives that day as well. So
Anna, no tip spells backwards is spit on. True story. Yikes. Wow. Oh. 708, this is how I tip. All servers start out with 20%, but if there are mistakes, then I make deductions. So lots of people doing that. I think we just have to remember that $6.40 an hour or $4.95 an hour is what in Illinois people are getting, depending on if you're in Chicago or outside of Chicago. So those people really are relying on those tips to, you know, to make their Christmas happen and to make to feed their own families as well.
Absolutely. I cover the restaurant industry because I do a lot of stories for the Chicago Sun-Times on local restaurants. And it's absolutely vital whether they can, you know, if they have a good night, maybe you're able to meet rent. And if you don't have a good night, maybe you're not able to. It's a very volatile business.
So think about that, I guess. Thanks for weighing in. We appreciate the comments, and there's more to come here on WGN Radio, including Shia Kappas with more on local politics. Hannah DeVlantis here with Shia Kappas. She writes Politico's Illinois Playbook, a daily rundown directed right to your inbox every morning. All things local politics, everything you want to know. Shia, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Fun to be here.
I read through yours. I always read your blog every day, but this morning I read through it and I thought, gosh, there is so much that happened this weekend that I feel like I missed a lot of it because some of it happened on Friday night. Some of it happened throughout the weekend, and then there are some ongoing issues too you touched upon, and you always have those fascinating nuggets that I would never see anywhere else. So we want to talk about that as well, including the billionaires giving to Biden here locally, the local millionaires and billionaires. But the thing that happened Friday night, and I referenced this earlier, is Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot was at this event. Was it for mayors exclusively?
It was the U.S. Council of Mayors. Yes, they had their annual, or I don't know if it's annual, they had a meeting in Iowa designed to have presidential candidates there interviewing each other. And Lori Lightfoot was, she picked, or somebody picked for her to interview Pete Buttigieg. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting combination because they're both, you know,
prominent gay
and lesbian political leaders. And everybody was wondering, you know, what were they going to say?
And that was what was so interesting, because it didn't go as I would have expected it to go. It didn't go. I've covered a number of these things in my career as a reporter, and it did not go how I've witnessed these things going in the past. We have a soundbite from that exchange. Here it is.
You said you can't talk about your work at McKinsey because of a non-disclosure agreement. You think said today that you got to honor your commitment to McKinsey. I'm asking you, shouldn't you break that NDA so that you have the moral authority and the high ground against somebody like Trump, who hides behind the lack of transparency to justify everything that he's doing?
So here's what I'm doing. First of all, I just pushed out a bunch of information about each of the engagements that I did when I was at McKinsey. This is my first job out of school. It's not like I was the CEO. I was making a lot of spreadsheets and PowerPoints. But people ought to know, from somebody who proposes to be the president of the United States, what's in your past. And just as I have considered it important to release all of the tax returns from when I first entered the private sector, something not all of my competitors,
they could fix this tonight.
So there, it just seemed like a more pointed question, a little more pressing than you normally see in these kinds of scenarios. She's basically saying, hey, break that NDA, that non-disclosure. Tell us what you covered. We want, or tell us what you worked on as a consultant at this, at McKinsey. Is that important? How did you read this exchange? What was going on there?
What's interesting is when this whole encounter was talked about, we were told that Lori Lightfoot would be asking basically a softball question that the organizers gave her. And maybe she saw that announcement and said, well, I'm not going to do that, because she really dug in. What's interesting, what people in Chicago, I think, find interesting is that, you know, her campaign was kind of came under the spotlight for who her clients were when she worked at Mayor Brown law firm. And I'm not sure that any reporter, I didn't ask for all of her clients. There's not a list of all of her clients out there. So it's interesting that, you know, she would be pressing somebody in a similar situation, asking for his clients and to come forward with all that.
She is about transparency, if nothing else. And I think we expect a high degree of that because of that platform, because of the reform platform, because she's saying, let's put it all out in the open and let the voters decide how things should go. Her quote on it was, I never worked on a project inconsistent with my values. And if asked to do so, I would have left the firm rather than participate. So I'll take her at face value at that. But Pete Buttigieg, is it that important that this?
Which he said the same thing similarly, you know, that he would not have worked for a client whose ethics diverted from his values. So they both sort of said the same thing. And she's just asking him to be more transparent. And he's saying, well, I can't be transparent because McKinsey is the one that has to release it.
I will back that up. It seems that McKinsey is one of those elite consulting firms, or one of the best in the best in the world. And they don't allow their consultants to explain exactly the client they're working on. I've been associated with people who work there, and they'll just say, I'm working with a retailer in the Midwest, and then they don't tell you anymore. And
I'm sure that retailer probably requires that too. It's maybe it's not all McKinsey, maybe it's the clients themselves, but
It's fascinating to see that kind of interchange. And she hasn't made an endorsement yet, has she?
She has not made an endorsement. Mm-hmm. And she probably won't until closer to the convention, unless something happens, you know. Mm-hmm. Lots can happen before July, and maybe she'll step out and
do something there.
Do something. A lot of people have been courting her. All the candidates have been courting her. So it'll be interesting to see how she...
Yeah. Let's talk about Biden's billionaire, local billionaire donors. I hadn't seen this elsewhere, but I think you did pick it up from Forbes.
Right.
But it's pretty detailed here. Melody Hobson, the successful businesswoman herself, financial dynamo married to movie mogul George Lucas, has given money to Biden. She also supported Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, but she's giving money to Biden. Who else do you have on your list here?
Well, Neil Bloom, he gave $2,800. He's interesting because he's a big real estate mogul in town, and he has casinos around the country, including Chicago. So he's an interesting person giving money. Liz Lifkovsky, who is the wife of one of the Groupon founders, she gave money. And so did Meg Whitman, who has an Illinois connection. She has, you know, she's originally from Illinois way back when, and she gave money to Biden. All of these people, or a lot of them, have given money elsewhere too. So,
kind of hedging their bets, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe is that the way you read it?
Maybe. What I found especially interesting was that Melody Hobson and George Lucas not only gave the standard $2,800 to Biden, but they have given $70,000 to the two big Democratic organizations, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And that is a lot of dough to give to the Democratic Party.
It is, very much so. Is Bloomberg taking money at all? Because he says he has $100 million already set aside for his
campaign. I don't know. I haven't looked to see that he's taking money.
It's fascinating because he is dropping a lot of money amongst the broadcasting and different organizations across the Midwest, even putting a lot of money from his very healthy campaign fund. But it just seemed interesting to see Biden getting that kind of support when the trend line for him has not been the best. He's had several missteps on the campaign trail, but seems a lot of people still saying, hey, he's very possible that he could be the guy.
Right. And I was interested in this piece, too, because I had been looking for a while to find out who were the people in Chicago who were backing him, money-wise or delegate-wise. And it was really quiet until the past 2 weeks, and then this popped up. So that made it interesting. I think people are coalescing maybe behind him to some extent.
Also making news, you can see it in your blog, is Mayor Emanuel taking names. Certainly somebody known to be outspoken, but he took to the podium here at the Gridiron Winter Dinner in D.C. It's a big muckety-muck dinner, right, in the Beltway. I guess no cameras were allowed because I was trying to find the audio from
media.
But he took aim at absolutely everyone in the Democratic Party, and he was funny.
He was really funny. He always has been funny at those things. He poked fun at Michael Bloomberg, saying, "It's insane. It's crazy to think that America is looking for a short Jewish president." Really? Because if they were, I'd be running. But bum. You know, he was really
funny. Right. And then he talked about Hillary Clinton, too. He weighed in on her, saying that a lot of people are asking her to run. She keeps saying that in her interviews as she's being interviewed. A lot of people saying, hey, when are you going to get into the race? And he's saying, are any of those people from Wisconsin, Michigan, or Pennsylvania, or are any of them even Democrats? I mean, he really did not hold back, but he's friendly with all these people, so they all know this is tongue-in-cheek.
This is tongue-in-cheek, and it's all a shtick. So.
Yes. Another thing about Mayor Lightfoot that you touch on here, and it's an interesting thing, is that she does not seem, she's bucking the trend of Democrats nationally and locally when it comes to the more progressive wing of the party, sort of pushing Democrats to appeal to them. And the item you have today talks about how she's not really doing that.
Right. There are a lot of mayors across the country, like you say, who feel a lot of pressure as it's maybe in response to this Trump effect where the Democrats are leaning far left, so there's a push by the socialist candidates and progressive candidates for support for Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. And so we asked around, and Lori Lightfoot is just not somebody who is going to be swayed that way, in part because she doesn't need to be. I mean, she's in Chicago, which is a progressive city. She is an African-American, lesbian, reformist mayor. So she can pretty much do what she wants. And she's already proven that she can, you know, duke it out with the socialists and defend herself and isn't going to be pulled their way.
I think she's also made it clear that the business community is important to the future of the success of Chicago as well, and that growing our numbers and growing jobs here is the way we pull our way out of this financial crisis. That is a piece of the equation while still allowing all of the neighborhoods of Chicago to participate. It's a difficult balance to strike, right, but it seems as if that has been her focus to do so.
I think that happens with anybody who comes into office. You may, you have these idealistic goals of what you think government should be, but then when you're faced with the numbers, mm-hmm, you know?
You're like, hey, how do we get out of this mess? Right, we got to do something fast. Shia Kappas, thank you so much from Politico. People can sign up for your newsletter if they'd like to. Where do they go for that, Shia?
Go to Politico or email me directly at skappas@politico.com.
Wonderful. Thank you for stopping by. Coming up here on WGN Radio, Karen Conti is going to be here. She's going to talk about this new sick day policy where you have to call a nurse before you can get a paid sick day. It's at Chipotle. It's a new policy. It's not exactly sitting well with everyone. We're going to talk to her about that and much more coming up here on WGN Radio. All right, let's turn to this subject now. This a sick day policy that is, well, it's not being well received by everyone. In fact, a lot of people have a problem with this one. It's Chipotle, Chipotle Mexican Grill. You know the restaurant. They have announced that now they have nurses and health professionals on staff to make sure that when employees call in sick, that they're actually sick. And I want to ask Karen Conti, does this seem right to you? Is this even legal?
Well, it just seems a strange thing to do, especially considering the problems that Chipotle had a couple of years ago. If you recall, about 700 people got sick from food poisoning from their place. So if you really want to make sure your employees are safe to go to work, why would you make it harder to have a sick day? Because you don't want people who are sick coming to the workplace with the idea that they're going to spread perhaps some sort of virus or germs or what have you. So it's a strange thing to begin with. And the second part of this is there's an element apparently that they want to make sure you don't have a hangover. That's mm-hmm. what at least the media part said. So I'm thinking to myself, so you call the nurse and the nurse says, hey, did you have 5 drinks yesterday? Are you hungover? And of course the employee says no,
right.
even if she did.
Right.
And what is that going to do? How is that going to help anybody?
That's exactly what it says here. So Chipotle has health professionals on hand. They want to know if you're ill or if you're just taking a paid off to nurse a hangover. This is from the CEO, an actual interview with their CEO. And then he told it to investors at a conference this week. And they're saying that we have the nurses on call so that if you say, hey, I've been sick, you're going to get a call from them and the nurse will validate that it's not something like a hangover, something you're faking it, I suppose, that you're really in fact sick. And then and only then will we pay you for a sick day. That piece of it seems to me, would anybody have a case there? Maybe you don't want to reveal your medical history or everything about what's going on, or maybe you have a chronic illness that's starting and you don't want to lose your health insurance. I mean, there could be a number. This is your health, and it feels like some of that should be private.
It should, although interestingly, the law says that employers can ask the person if we're giving you sick days. And by the way, the law does not say generally in Illinois that an employer must pay for sick days. There's a new law in Chicago that says that, and that's an aside. But so the employer can call up and say, I just want to document that you're sick. You know, tell me generally about it. We don't have to go into the details of it, nor do you have to document it. But the employer can do it. There's nothing wrong with that. And a lot of people might think that is some sort of breach of privacy or HIPAA. HIPAA doesn't apply to employers. HIPAA just applies to hospitals and doctors and medical providers. So, yeah, the employer can do that. The problem is, as you noted, what if it was something that goes over the line? It might be a disability, which would then be protected by other laws like the Americans with Disabilities Act.
I see. So if you were coming into an area where you did really have something seriously wrong and you'd be afraid to talk about it, but you would be protected if your situation did fall under that umbrella.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of is a strange thing because, okay, you don't have a right to a sick day generally unless you work in the city of Chicago, and there's some whistles and bells on that. If it's a certain number of employees, then you do get some certain paid sick days. Usually it's about 40 hours. So you're entitled to it, but what the employer can make rules about how you qualify and probably make you fill out a form, give the general nature of the illness just to make sure that people aren't taking off too much time, and that's appropriate. But when it crosses over and starts to invade privacy, and then maybe, like, let's just say I have epilepsy and I didn't want to tell my employer that, and my employer doesn't like the fact that I have epilepsy, well, then that might be something that is covered by the American with Disabilities Act, which requires the employer to accommodate a person who has such an ailment. So it's kind of a mixture of things. I guess I don't understand, Anna, what benefit this is for anybody here, the employer or the employee. It shouldn't be that hard to take a sick day where you feel like you're spilling your guts and you're, you know, you have to answer intrusive questions.
Right.
And what's the difference if you're hungover or you have a sick day, or you hurt your arm playing softball, or you were up with your baby all night? What's the difference? If you're sick, you're sick. If you're out, you're out.
It's a great point, especially when you work in food service. You would think any type of sort of feeling down, or you're not even sure, maybe you're getting the flu, but you're just sort of feeling kind of groggy, you might be a good idea to stay home.
Well, right, and maybe you don't want a hungover employee in, you know, cutting up vegetables.
Right.
With
like
a sharp knife.
Watch out, there's another problem there. Deanna says, the news of Chipotle's policy reminds people of how Chipotle made so many people sick. Just when we're starting to forget, bad PR. There's a point to that, a big point there. And you sort of raised it. Remember, the E. coli outbreak that forced like dozens of restaurants to close. Chipotle had to close its doors. You just had this gross feeling about it for a while. And they said this, though, is part of that new initiative. Not only are we swabbing our restaurants and we have these new health safety issues that we're going to, these new protocols, I should say, where they're going to just get everything super duper clean, but that employee illness is part of the picture. I just wonder if the employees are going to look at this as part of a safety thing or a little bit of a interfering on their rights or their feelings as an employee.
Big brother. And again, I think it's counterintuitive because you would almost think in order to come back, you would want a nurse to make sure you were okay to come back so you're not spreading germs and bacteria to people who might be eating the food. So why make it harder to take off rather than, it just doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't. 708, I was a fireman and we could be disciplined if we were feigning or maligning illness or injury. So I guess on some jobs, you can face discipline for that kind of thing?
Oh, sure. And you can put that in your policy handbook. And in a public governmental workplace, there can be rules about that kind of stuff. Certainly, you don't want your police officers and your firemen and your maybe even your politicians lying. God forbid.
No, that never happens.
Boy, no, it never happened.
Wow. About bigger things than being sick, that's for sure. 847, pregnancy can bring on a multitude of symptoms that could interfere with your work, but isn't necessarily labeled sick. That's another point. Maybe you're not prepared to tell your employer that you're pregnant yet. So if you start describing the symptoms of morning symptoms to a nurse, then you start revealing some little more than you're prepared to.
Well, that's right. And also, take it one step further. If the employer was discriminating against you because you had morning sickness, that would be a gender discrimination issue, because if a guy is sick and he's just sick because he's got the flu and a woman is sick because she's got morning sickness, you can't parse one over the other, because clearly women are the only ones who get pregnant, last I checked. So that would be discrimination.
Karen, can we weigh in on something else here? This is another employment issue since we're here. We've seen a number of high-profile executives ousted over affairs with subordinates lately, affairs with other employees. And I think a lot of people have questions about this. McDonald's CEO comes to mind. Last week, the front of the Wall Street Journal read I think it was a BlackRock financial firm, that huge multi-billion dollar firm. He resigned amid an affair with an employee. And I think there is a little bit of confusion about what the rules are generally. Let's say you are single and the other person is single and you want to start dating a fellow employee who happens to work with you. Is it always wrong if they're a subordinate? And what can you do if it's maybe a peer? How do you handle that kind of thing?
Sure. Generally, there's nothing illegal about dating someone in the workplace. It generally isn't a good idea, especially when one is subordinate. And here's why. If you are having an affair with the boss, and the boss maybe treating you a little bit better, or there's a perception that he is treating you a little bit better, the other employees look around and go, what do I have to do in order to get ahead in this workplace? Do I have to have an affair with the boss? And that's when you have the quid pro quo sexual harassment suits that say that we felt uncomfortable because the boss is having an affair with someone who's competing for my job. And so that's the problem. And you know, in the case of the CEO at McDonald's, I think it was well known that this was going on. I don't think they had even much to do with it, but the policy at McDonald's was being violated. And I think when the CEO at that point was violating its own corporate policy, that's when it became a fireable offense.
In most cases, if it's a peer, someone who's not below you, someone who's on the same level as you, is that okay? Do you just go ahead and disclose it? What do you do?
Yeah, well, you first have to look at the policy handbook, because it could be that your employer has a specific rule that says no dating amongst employees. And let me tell you, more and more employers are doing that now because of the Me Too movement, because people are feeling uncomfortable, because we don't want any of those tensions in the workplace. So that's the first thing. And remember, most employees are employees at will, which means you can be fired for any reason. So let's just say there's no policy handbook. There's nothing that says you can't date somebody. You're dating someone and the boss says, you know what, you're dating someone, I don't like it, you're fired. The employer can do that. So the best case scenario is just not to date someone in the workplace, although, as we all know, you spend a lot of time there, you know, right? Sometimes more than you do in your own home. So it happens.
Really quickly, just a few seconds left here, Karen, but the impeachment hearings got off fiery start. You saw protests, a lot of shouting back and forth. Take the politics out of it, and we'll all make up our minds on what we think about this. I don't think a lot of minds have changed so far, but maybe that changes too. I don't know. But what's happening legally right now? Breakdown, is this lawmakers submitting the final case for impeachment? Where are we in this legally?
Well, there's going to be the articles of impeachment, which are, it's more like an indictment. Don't think of it as impeachment as a kicking out of office. That's kind of how a lot of people think of it. It's really just the indictment. These are the charges that are being leveled against our president. So once those are out, once those are in writing, then there's going to be a vote. And the vote is largely political. People keep saying, what are the legalities of impeachment? The legalities of impeachment are whatever the people voting think might be a misdemeanor or a high crime. And listen, lying in a deposition about an extramarital affair got Bill Clinton impeached. So you can see that there really is no high standard or low standard for this kind of thing.
There's a lot of leeway. There's a lot of range there. Karen Conti
exactly.
from Conti Law Group, we appreciate you weighing in. As always, thank you so much. Talk to you
soon. And congratulations on your solo voyage.
Thank you, Karen. The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Stay with us here on WGN Radio. That song can mean only one thing. This is Anna DeBlancis, and we have David Hochberg of Team Hochberg in studio, along with Ray Kaplan from the Kaplan Law Firm. They are answering your money questions. If you have a financial question, they know how to save you money. They know the answer. They know how to restructure debt, all kinds of money ideas that will, in fact, save you money. We have many, many people who have told us that they are very thankful for both of you and the advice that you have given them. You have a new podcast, too, or a new show. Let's talk about that first, just to get to let people know where they can hear you.
Well, we have a show starting here on WGN on the 4th, the 1st September in January,
okay.
called Home Sweet Home Chicago. And it's a real estate show following Lou Manfredini's show. We're going to it's a caller-based show.
What day?
Saturdays, 10 until noon.
Great time.
Super,
okay.
super excited. Looking forward to it. Lots of information and just helping out listeners on After Lou's show on Saturday.
All right, so listen in WGN Radio on Saturdays and hear you guys. And we've got some questions that we have to ask right now, too. Credit card debt, let's start with that. Huge issue in the U.S. It hit an all-time high last year, surpassing even the financial crisis years, which really tells you something. Here's the only good news is that people are getting a little smarter about what credit cards they get. They're looking at interest rates a little more than they used to. And they're also looking for those rewards cards. I feel like sometimes those can be deceiving because you hear these great rewards are front loaded with $400 or $200 that you get up front. And then later, maybe it doesn't always pay off. You have advice for people when they're looking for credit cards, David?
Yeah, I always tell people, and I think Ray will agree with this, you know, credit card, it's not the credit card. It's carrying the balance on the credit card.
Exactly.
It's great to have the credit card, okay, because you get the points, you get the miles, you get the cheaper gas, you get the free underpants, whatever you're, if you got Victoria's Secrets, which everybody should have, it's holiday
really?
Season. Yeah, you
get that
you build
for your
up,
wife.
You build up points, and, the credit card isn't the evil. It's the person using the credit card, using it too much where they, when the bill comes at the end of the month, Ray, they don't have enough dough to pay it off.
Right, yeah. Just carrying those balances, paying the interest and not touching the principal. I can't tell you how many people I've seen over the years that did not understand that the payments that they were making were not chipping away the principal balance.
That's going to take them forever. Don't they have new rules, though, in place that have to make it clearer what you actually owe and
Tila.
How long it will take in order to pay it off? Because that's always the freakiest thing to look at. If you pay the minimum payment, you will be paying it off in 2097 or
Who
something.
Who reads that, though?
I kind of do, buddy. And it freaks me out.
Yeah, listen, you can give people disclosures all you want, but nobody's going to read it.
Right.
Okay, it says, open up a credit card, you get $300 free. Okay, nothing. First of all, nothing's free. Okay, number one. And number two, if you're looking to refinance going forward or you're looking about ready to close a home and you're out there holiday shopping, buyer beware, because lenders have to pull your credit before you close to make sure you haven't taken on any new debt.
Right.
So all of that new debt. Okay, you know, it's great, all those car commercials with the big bow and you go out, blow 19, 20, 50, 100 grand on a car. Great. But that car typically comes with a $300 to $1,500 car payment.
Car insurance.
Car insurance, all of that stuff. And then, you know, you have to pull money out of your savings to put a down payment. And a lot of people don't realize that when we pull, if you go out and you started a mortgage with a lender in October,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to close at the end of December, it's usually a 45 to 60 day lag.
Okay.
And you go out and you load up on Christmas shopping or holiday shopping,
mm-hmm.
and then you go buy a car. And then we pull the credit, lender pulls a credit before you close to make sure you haven't taken on any new debt. And all of a sudden, there's $10,000 worth of credit cards on new credit cards you
You're
open.
Not going to get the loan you thought you were going to get. You're not going to get the house.
You might disqualify yourself from buying a home.
Right. You've messed up your debt-to-income ratio.
Thank
am
you.
I right? So the lender's looking at you, whereas before you might have been a promising risk for them to take, you're no longer a good candidate.
Yeah.
So yeah,
balance transfers. Is that ever a good idea? Credit card to credit card? Or what would you do if you say, hey, I've got this number on my credit card right now. I don't
Sometimes.
Like it there. Where am I pushing? Where am I putting it? That's
depends,
the best place
right?
for me.
Right. It depends. I think the best way when you want to do balance transfers is if you have one credit card where, let's say, you've used 70 to 80% of your available credit limit,
mm-hmm.
and you have another one where you've hardly used it, you might want to do a balance transfer, provided that other one you're transferring to is a low interest rate and it's not going to kill you. But you want to have your credit cards, ideally you try not to go above 30 to 40% of your available credit limit. That's where the kind of sweet spot is for a period of time so that potential lenders can see that you can handle your credit cards, that you're not maxed out on everything and making minimal monthly payments. Because I think there's a misconception out there where people think that, oh, well, as long as I make the minimum payment, then my credit's going to be good. No, it's not going to be good because lenders can see that you have maxed out or you're close to maxing out and you're only making minimum payments. That doesn't look good.
Mm-hmm.
And just to break it down for our listeners,
yeah,
what Ray was saying, 30 to 40%, what does that mean? That means if you have a $1,000 limit, you can't exceed, and I tell everybody 30%. So
right.
don't exceed $300 on your credit card.
That's
and that's
right.
And that's why I live by the every Friday rule. Use it, pay it off every Friday. Okay, because then if you pay it off every Friday, if you can, or pay it off every pay period, you only have 1 or 2 weeks worth of charges on there. So if you have a $1,000 limit and you have a $300 balance, you really don't want to exceed that, because once you cross over that, it really starts negatively impacting your credit scores, which means higher interest rates on credit card debt, car loans, and mortgages.
Right. A few seconds here before we break, and then we want your questions. 312-981-7200. Your questions for David Hochberg, Ray Kaplan as well. Credit score, you mentioned credit scores.
Yeah.
If you go from 100 points, or what difference does that make in terms of a rate? Put it in real terms
in terms of
trying to get that score up.
1 point between a 680 and a 679 will cost you $50,000 in mortgage payments on a $250,000 mortgage. I've
wow.
run it
wow.
a number of times.
Wow.
Say that
one more time.
The difference between a 679 and a 680 credit score will cost the borrower on a $250,000 mortgage, because of the higher interest rate, right? It goes in 20-point blocks.
Okay.
So 700 to 719 is one score, 720 to 739, 740 on up. And then it goes, once you go south of 700, the rates start going up. Once you go south of 680, it's a huge increase in the rate. And what listeners don't realize is that 1 point, 679, if your middle score is a 679, it's a dead stop. and that could cost you $50,000 more over a 30-year fixed mortgage on a $250,000 mortgage.
So it's worth it to wait and get your credit up that one point, right?
Right.
Ray Kaplan is our guest. So is David Hochberg. We're taking your financial questions. We have callers. We're going to get to your calls coming up here after the break. Stay with us here on WGN Radio. Our guests, Ray Kaplan from the Kaplan Law Firm and David Hochberg from Team Hochberg. Jim, you've been waiting for a while. Thank you for waiting. You have a question about no-cost refinances. You're on WGN Radio.
Yes. Is there a product like that?
Yes. If you want to pay a higher rate, you could get a no-cost refinance. How it works is it's based
on... But I don't want to do that.
Well, then you can't have a no-cost refinance. I mean, we're just talking about pecan pies.
I have to have a higher rate to get a no cost, or you roll it in the loan or the principal?
Correct. Yes, you have two choices. Number one, you get quoted a low rate and roll the costs in, or a slightly higher rate, which the lender makes a slightly greater premium and then gives you a credit back with the premium through the higher rate. You don't hear that in the ads, but all you hear is no closing costs, no closing costs, no closing costs. You don't hear that in my ads. But other people like to do that, and that's how they do it. You will be in a higher rate than you would receive if you roll the closing costs in. Now, it's some, I've done hundreds, if not thousands, of no closing costs. You know, it's not a no closing cost. It's a closing cost credit, right? And in a lot of instances, it makes a lot of sense. In some instances, they don't. So you've got to. It's
buyer. What's the rule of thumb on the higher rate?
What's that?
Versus. What's the rule of thumb difference between higher rate and not higher rate?
Well, there's really not a specific rule of thumb because for some people with 740 credit scores, the differential in the rate to cover your closing costs will be a lot smaller than somebody with a lower credit score.
All right.
So it's all over the board, buddy.
All right, Jim, thank you. Thank you for your call. Thanks for calling WGN. Hope that helps. I have another question here. My credit is 835. How can I get it higher? I think a lot of people would love to have an 835. Isn't that near perfect?
Love those, don't
it's
you?
Pretty good.
Yeah. Listen, if it's over 740, you know, my brother-in-law and sister-in-law, I refinanced them. He was a 780, 790, and a 787, and she was 790, 796, and an 803. And he's like, how come hers is higher than mine? I'm like, dude, I'm dealing with people with 550s over here. Okay?
Call me when you have a problem.
I'm like stop yourself.
I understand that, all right? So, okay, so your life is good, okay?
Right, yeah.
Be happy,
relax.
630. Yeah. Relax. Merry Christmas. All right, we want to talk about student debt a little bit. And, Ray, I know you're an expert in this. I hear you talk about it all the time. There are ways to bring that student debt down. There are things you can do. It doesn't matter if you work for a nonprofit, because those stories have made a lot of headlines lately.
Right.
If you work for a nonprofit, there are a lot of some things you can do. But you have said over and over, it doesn't matter. There are things you can do.
Absolutely. I think one of the most important things is planning how you're going to finance your kids' education before you actually get there. So if you understand the fact that federal loans are available for both the student and the parent. So for federal loans for the student, a lot of times the loans that they're going to qualify for aren't going to cover the actual cost of tuition. And then what happens is a lot of people panic and they take out private loans, which are not flexible and not forgiving. What you actually should do is stay away completely from private loans. And as the parent, take out federal Parent Plus loans. And now we're only talking
federal
about financing
parent
undergrad.
Plus loans.
Right.
Okay.
Federal Parent Plus loans, you'll qualify for them if you can qualify to get a Capital One credit card. So even if you're not working, if you're on Social Security, if you have a pulse, you are going to qualify for Federal Parent Plus loans, and you can finance. There's no cap. There's no limit. You can take out $200,000 to finance what it will cost your kids to go to school. And then you don't have to make payments till the kid graduates. And then one point I wanted to make too is that the parent that makes the least amount of money is the one that should take out the loans. And I know that sounds counterintuitive, mm-hmm. but the reason for that is that when we go to calculate what the payment's going to be, according to the law, it's going to be based on the borrower. So if the borrower is making $40,000 or $50,000 a year, that's the one, and the other parent's making $100,000. You want the parent who's making less money to take out those loans. And then the payment is going to be very, very low, and the balance will be forgiven after a period of time.
What if you're not lucky enough to have a parent help you pay for your student loans? Is there an option you suggest for the student who's saying, hey, this is what do I need?
Well, the student will qualify for federal loans. And for undergrad, there are caps. But for graduate school, there's no caps. So for graduate school, there is virtually no limit on what you can take out in federal graduate school loans, and those also are subject to the same law that allows you to pay 10% of your gross disposable income and have the balance wiped out. So we have situations all the time where people owe $150,000, $200,000, and because of their situation, they're only going to pay back $10,000, $20,000, and the balance will be forgiven.
What is that rule about somebody who works for a charitable organization? It's a 501c organization, is that right?
Right, it's a not-for-profit, a 501c3, so you have to work there full-time. So you can work for any government entity, public school teacher, or nurse at a hospital that's a not-for-profit. So here in Chicago, that would be...
They qualify.
Advocate, Amita, Northwestern, those qualify. And that means that you only have to pay in for 120 months. And sometimes even if the payment is $0 a month, those payments count towards 120 payments and then the balance forgiven.
Let me ask a question about sanitary workers.
Right.
That work for 501c3.
Like that work for the city or something.
Right. Do they qualify?
Streets and sand. Are you talking about streets and sand?
Yeah,
streets
and sand. Right.
There you go.
So and we actually have a few of those people. Yep. They qualify. Even if you work at a hospital and you're cleaning crew, you're eligible for 501c for that public sector loan forgiveness.
People don't know this.
That is on your interesting. Loans so if you want to become a nurse one day or you want to move up the chain within the hospital,
So the main thing is just don't take out private loans, because sometimes you go to work with your financial aid officer and they don't know and they're pushing these private loan applications in front of you. And the main thing is that the Department of Ed has to be the lender. That's the thing to look for. And you can just go to studentloans.gov and you can apply for all federal loans there.
I got Tom
waiting on the line, David.
Tom,
you're on WGN Radio.
Is that Anna looking out for me there?
See, I knew you've been hanging on for a while, and I was like, I don't want Tom to feel like we don't love him. I don't need what he has to say.
I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. And an honor to talk to you all. And Dave, is Dave there?
Yes, sir.
Dave Hochberg is right here. So is Ray Kaplan.
All right, Dave. I got one for you, Dave. First-time home buyer. Young man, you know how the youth of America is, David.
Yes.
A 593 credit score. Are there any credits out there for a first-time home buyer with a 593 credit score?
You would most likely look at, are you a veteran to qualify for VA?
No. It's fine. I'm calling on behalf of a nephew.
Your nephew, you're most likely at that credit score looking at an FHA loan, which there's nothing wrong with that. You're looking at putting at least 10% down. What I would recommend to your
nephew... With FHA, David? 10% down?
10% down with that type of credit score. FHA has as low as 3.5% down, but when you get under... into the credit score where your nephew's at, they're going to require a 10% down payment. What I would strongly recommend to your nephew is to call a credit enhancement expert by the name of Gary Novell. His number, I'll give you his number, 630-624-9557. You want a gift that keeps on giving, it's the gift of credit enhancement. 630-624-9557. If you or your nephew calls Gary, and when Gary helps your nephew enhance his credit, he's got to make the initial investment, I will credit the fee back to your nephew as a closing cost credit when your nephew goes to buy the home.
Put a bow on that. That sounds like a great gift.
Yeah, all right, Dave. All right, man. You the man. I appreciate
that. Thank you,
man.
Tom. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
We've got another caller here as well. Jasmine, are you ready to put it through to us? She's giving me just a second. I want to ask you guys about this, too. This was came out last week, and I want to ask you if you think this is a resource for people who are going into college. You're about to apply for loans, and you're about to take that leap. collegescorecard.ed.gov. It basically assembles all the data, and it allows you to enter in the college or university, any of them that you want to go to, all your choices, enter your major. It'll estimate your earnings post-college and the debt you'll acquire. And I wonder if you think that ratio is something more people should be looking at as they approach college, because one of the things we keep hearing is people who say, I've graduated now, and there's no way my earnings are enough to pay the loans I've accrued, and I don't even see future earnings that would help me do that.
Right. I do think it's a good tool, because I think when you're deciding what you want to major in and whether or not you want to make that investment to go to school to major in, say, basket weaving, maybe plug in those numbers, and it's not going to be such a good idea, because you're going to see that your gross income is not going to be enough to pay off the loans that you're going to acquire. But I will say again, federal loans, most of the time you're going to be able to pay whatever they're, if you're doing it the right way and you're in an income-driven payment plan, the payment is going to be so low, you're going to be able to afford it.
What we're seeing is an entire generation with has accrued so much student debt that they're putting off buying that home, and you both must see this all the time because you deal in those fields. And is it possible when you have student debt to afford a home in the city of Chicago or even the surrounding areas? We have high prices here. It's not cheap to buy a home. There's a way to do it.
When you call Ray Kaplan and Ray Kaplan reorganizes your federal, and I'm not just saying that because she's sitting here. She helped a friend of mine, 56-year-old guy married to a 54-year-old woman living up in the North Shore, save $250,000 on their student loans. He called me up, says, "Is Ray Kaplan for real?" I said, "Absolutely." Ray was on my show earlier in the year. I'm like, "She's a real McCoy, buddy. Call her." Called him about 6 weeks later. I get a call. I'm coming out, have a meeting. He's like, "I can't thank you enough." I'm like, "What'd I do?" He's like, "You introduce us to Ray, she's going to save us $250,000.
It makes a difference. People, I mean, it's the most important purchase you're probably going to make in your lifetime.
It's unbelievable. And he could take that money to pay down his mortgage and other debt that he'd accumulated because he sent his three kids to college, and him and his wife agreed to pay for it. And two of them just decided to go for grad school, which was another couple hundred grand.
Right. And I know exactly what you're talking about. And it's fantastic because it really, there's no downside to this. There's no downside to what the statute actually allows you to do in terms of structuring your student loan debt.
Mm-hmm. So there's an interesting proposal out of Washington, and I say interesting with little air quotes around it. I don't know that I love this. I want to see what you think. It's called the Helper Act that has been suggested to allow people to borrow from their 401k every year, tax-free, penalty-free, in order to pay for their student loans. And I just wonder, is that the way out of this? Does that help people?
I don't like that idea, actually. I think that there are far better uses for that money than having to pay your federal student loan debt, especially in light of the statute, the law that already exists that makes it so forgiving. I actually had clients in my office who came from Ireland, and they were saying, well, you know, in Ireland, you can send your kids to school for a couple $1,000 a year. We actually structured it so that they're going to end up taking about $200,000 in federal loans to finance their kids' education and paying back $2,500.
Ray Kaplan from the Kaplan Law Firm and David Hochberg from Team Hochberg, thank you as always for the advice. Come back again. We have so many more questions, and also listen to you on Saturdays at
10 until noon, starting January 4th of next year, the first Saturday of the year. We're going to be in right after Lou Manfredini show. Looking forward to it.
We'll be listening. Great. Thanks, guys. We're back with more in a moment. Anna DeVlantz is live in the Skyline Studios for you here on WGN. A number of stories coming out about Uber recently, and we have a rideshare expert joining us now. He's a local Chicago attorney. He deals with a lot of safety issues with Uber and is up to speed on so many of the issues that have made headlines lately. His name is Bryant Greening. Bryant, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So there are just so many things that have come out lately, but I do want to go to that one story out of London where they banned Uber from essentially operating there. They yanked their license and they said it was over a safety concern. But the why piece of that story, I think because it was in London, sort of got lost. And the why piece of it, I think, is important. It talks about how drivers there, and an alarming number of them there, were sharing their profiles. They were basically driving for Uber. They apply, they get vetted, they get their car vetted. And then somebody else, family member, friend, starts driving for them. Sometimes they even were able to change profile pictures or change it so that you really didn't know who was driving. And the interesting part when I was reading those articles is you were quoted in many of these national news organizations. And I know you're a Chicago attorney, Legal Rideshare LLC is the name of your company. You were quoted as saying, is it happening elsewhere? And your feeling that I was sensing from it is that you're saying, absolutely, it does happen.
It absolutely happens in the United States, and it's happening in Chicago. It's a very scary proposition that the person who is supposed to be driving your Uber car or Lyft car might not be the one who actually shows up. We are hearing a lot of scuttle around the community that this is a problem that drivers are aware of and don't really know how to solve.
Well, so how is it done in your experience? Because I was reading the article and it just seemed as if, you know, other people were subbing out. Do they have to look like the original driver, or are they changing enough of the profile or showing a hazy enough profile that they were getting away with it? How did it work?
So a lot of times they're not changing the profile picture at all. We were actually at the O'Hare Airport parking lot where drivers wait to pick up fares from the airport. Mm-hmm. And there were drivers there who were pointing to specific vehicles saying, you see those three guys over there, they're just taking turns in one car picking up passengers. And that's allowing them to operate on the platform for an extended period of time, much longer than one person would normally be able to drive.
So what is the benefit of that is what? You share one car?
The benefit for the driver is that they can continuously make money. Oftentimes one driver can't put in that many hours. They get tired, they've got to use the bathroom, they got to get something to eat. This allows for continuous operation of the vehicle, and presumably those drivers are all sharing the proceeds.
And is there a benefit or a bonus that Uber gives for driving more hours? Is there some sort of incentive plan?
There are incentives that Uber puts out, such as drive a certain number of rides per week will give you a bonus. The city of Chicago actually imposes limits on the number of hours that one driver can operate as a rideshare driver. However, it's really tough to enforce that because when you hit your mark, your 10 hours, say, on Uber, you can then just turn on the Lyft app, and there's not really any way for them to share that data or check to make sure that driver isn't partaking in that practice.
Now, the downside of that to me as a passenger is you really don't know who's driving, and there are vetting processes that a driver has to go through in order to drive an Uber, right?
Yes, there's a background check, there's a vehicle inspection, there's also a rating system. So when you get in the back of an Uber car that's being operated the way that it should be, you have a certain amount of comfort that the company is vouching for this driver. They're saying, we did a background check. We believe that this person is safe. This person has a history with us as a driver, so they haven't committed some sort of crazy driving infraction. If a different person starts operating that vehicle, those checks suddenly disappear.
Mm-hmm. 630, I'm an Uber driver in Chicago. Uber is starting a PIN system which matches the right driver and the passenger. Have you heard about that?
I have heard about the PIN system, and Uber is trying to create a safer system. They're innovating. They've recently put in a emergency button. They're talking about recording the inside of the cars. Obviously, there may be some privacy issues that need to be discussed there. The bottom line is the company needs to keep trying, keep innovating, keep using its resources until rideshare is safe for everybody who gets inside the car.
Speaking of safety, the big headline last week, and I want to get to that, is Uber did voluntarily release its first safety report. Thursday, I believe it came across nearly 6,000 claims of sexual assault in 2017 and 2018, but they're reminding us that that was out of 1.3 billion rides. I guess that seems like a small number, but is there a way to crack down? Obviously, that's not okay. It's sort of a disturbing outcome of getting into a ride with someone you don't know. Do you know anything about the numbers of people? Were they people who were ride sharing? I mean, people who were using other people's profiles or shouldn't have been driving, but were anything in that data that you saw that stood out to you?
So we would argue that those numbers are unacceptable. One of the issues that Uber keeps running into is they're trying to contextualize everything. They're trying to say, here, we're going to be so transparent. We're going to put out this report. We're going to tell the public exactly what's right and wrong about the company. But then they say, please keep in mind, though, that there's all these billions of rides, so therefore these numbers aren't so bad. Uber needs to take responsibility for safety and should be doing everything that they can to get those figures as close to zero as absolutely possible.
Well, and you see in every industry, when you do a self-analysis, it's never as good as an independent analysis, right? We've seen all kinds of things that have happened in different types of industries when you say, okay, we're internally going to look into this. It's different than saying, let's bring in an outside data company or investigative team to look into our security data. But Uber seems very reluctant to do that. And maybe the other rideshare platforms are. They're just the largest, so they get the most attention.
Well, let me give you an example of where Uber kind of couched the numbers. We're a personal injury law firm. We deal with car accidents every day. When we talk about car accidents, Uber didn't put all the numbers out there. They talked about only fatalities. They talked about only periods 2 and 3, which is when the driver is actually connected with a passenger. What about all the time that the driver is spent cruising around the streets waiting to connect with a fare? How many accidents happened then? How many times was there a non-fatal occurrence where somebody suffered a serious injury, like a traumatic brain injury or a broken bone? Or a slipped disc in their back. These are the cases that happen all the time, and Uber's report is totally silent on that.
So you do handle cases where people have been in accidents involving a rideshare vehicle in general, not just Uber, Lyft, via any of the number of platforms, isn't that right?
Correct. Our law firm helps drivers, passengers, and victims of rideshare accidents. So what we mean by that is if you're a rideshare driver and you get injured, you can come to us. If you're a rideshare passenger and get injured, you can come to us. Or if a rideshare car hits you, you know, rear ends you, we're going to help with that as well. The numbers in Uber's report don't hit on a lot of those accidents. I can tell you that a significant number of what we see is period one accidents. So when that driver is just cruising around, you know, how often does that happen? I think Uber has a responsibility to tell the public what its drivers are doing and what kinds of issues they're facing.
Right. If anyone gets the paper copy of the Tribune, I know I do, there was a huge 2-page ad in the front section that says, alert our ride check technology, and we can check to see that drivers and riders are okay. It's uber.com/safety. There's some kind of a button you can press on your app if you're in trouble.
Correct. One of the things that Uber is doing well is that they're allowing people to track rides. So if your loved one is in the car, you can track their ride if they give you access to it, and then you get to make sure that they're doing okay. And if not, Uber will actually check in on you and make sure that, you know, the ride is going as it's supposed to.
Brian, just a few seconds left, but we have a texter from the 630 asks, Anna, can you find out if the driver's photo can be expanded on your phone? I found this too. I cannot, and sometimes the very small picture doesn't seem to be the same person driving. I've had that feeling too, or sometimes it's even a profile. Can you even expand it, or is there a way to double check that? The driver's the driver.
You know, I'm not positive that you can actually click on the photo and expand it like you would with a normal picture on
right.
your phone. One of the things that we want to make sure Uber does is requires better pictures, requires clear pictures,
yes.
requires pictures that are taken more often. We've heard rumblings that Uber might start requiring drivers to take photos each time that they get in the car to do some sort of evaluation or analysis to make sure it's the right person. Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound like a bad idea.
No, it sounds like it'd be a great idea. Thank you, Brian Greening. Brian Greening is our guest from Legal Rideshare LLC. He's a Chicago attorney who deals with all kinds of rideshare issues, especially safety and accidents and things like that. We appreciate you weighing in on a number of issues here, Brian. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Have a good rest of your afternoon. We're back with more here on WGN Radio coming up. All right. G. Suki is back in here as we talk about trending topics.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad you're here because this is fascinating stuff. Steve Harvey,
he did it
again.
What did he do?
The Miss Universe pageant was on, and, you know, he's the beauty pageant host, and he always seems to bungle a name or two or a situation or two. Well, here's what he did this time.
Oh, no.
Let's listen in.
Here's a look at the winner, Philippines. This is it right here. I thought I had on something fly, but girl, you just woo! Cake and oranges and potato chips. This is a lot. Yes.
It's not Philippines. It's Malaysia.
Oh, geez.
Okay, well, let me explain something to you. I just read that in the teleprompter. Y'all gonna quit doing this to me.
He was commenting on her costume and how great it was. And, of course, he called her the wrong thing.
Oh, oh no.
I wonder if they do this for ratings, but I don't think so. He seemed genuinely thrown off by that.
And I would imagine.
Do they do it on purpose?
There's no way. And
no.
I imagine that at this point, he is pretty upset. I would think that he probably had some choice words for the producers.
Because in 2015, that's when he announced the wrong winner, which
was
is
a big mistake.
Big mistake, because you think about the high hopes of the person who's
right.
Mispronounced, or the wrong winner is announced, and then the right one, and oh, wow. But Steve Harvey stepping into it.
But that's the thing about Steve, though. I mean, it's part of his charm, is mm-hmm. that you never know what he's going to say or how he's going to say it. And he's one of these celebrities that can get away
he
with
totally can.
Saying
somehow
anything
he, does.
He wants, right?
He totally does. But the look on her face, she was not letting him get away with that. She was like, you know, I'm going to need to tell you that that's not exactly
Maybe
what's
they
happening.
Need to do a rehearsal. I recommend that they do a full
Why not?
Rehearsal.
Why not with something like that, right? I feel like fewer people are watching these beauty pageants anyway. But
that's true.
It's
my mom still loves them,
she
though.
She does.
Mm-hmm.
The Miss Universe
she
in particular?
Too. Oh, yeah. She loves it. Mm. Loves it.
I used to watch them growing up. All right. More reaction to that ad, the Peloton ad, but this takes an interesting twist because the woman, you heard the story that the actor who is in it, he's a teacher, actually, that's his real job, and he said he was so horrified by the reaction to the ad that he felt as if kids at school or parents at school were associating him with the guy in the ad, even though he's an actor, and obviously that's his job to take on the role of gifting his wife with the Peloton bike.
And the issue was that the wife is really fit and skinny already.
It was hard to get to the issue because I felt like it was just gifting her something that she really wanted. She wanted this Peloton bike. It's extravagant. It's $2,200, and good for her. She gets it. But some people read it like he's fat shaming her, or
she's not
looking
fat.
For his approval.
But she's not. She looks like a triathlete.
Super thin, but that he was, I don't know, telling her that she needed to be thin. We did have some people who, not as many, but we had people weigh in here when we first covered it saying mm-hmm. they didn't like it either. And obviously you saw the stock price drop nearly $1 billion the next 24 hours because of the strange reaction. I think it was an overreaction, actually. But the new Peloton ad, this one stars the woman in that ad, and here she takes on a very different role.
This gin is really smooth.
Yeah.
We can get you another one,
mm-hmm. if you like.
You're safe here. To new beginnings.
To new beginnings.
There you go.
And they share a little gin, and they do a toast, and they say, "You look great, by the way." So it's actually a gin commercial. It's aviation gin, and they put her in this role just to say, hey, you know, look, she's hanging with the girlfriends. She's okay, and she looks great. Don't worry.
But she also looks shell-shocked, and they say this is a safe space. So does that mean she left the husband? Did she get so mad at the husband for giving her the gift?
Jazz, you found this. Producer Jasmine, you found this one. Did you read it? How did you read this one?
I think that that's what it was too, G. I'm with you.
Because she looked shell-shocked, upset, and then they said, you can have another one right after this. And she downed the first gin martini. I know what that's like. I've done that before. And the look on her face feels like a heartbroken, shocked face.
So maybe she's sort of reacting the next chapter. The company, by the way, they gave this statement, the gin company. The ad was meant to celebrate the fitness and wellness journey. So that was met by outrage.
Gin
without which
does not bring a lot of wellness.
I don't think so either. It's a way to sort of react to an awkward situation for her. That's maybe what they were trying to do there. But anyway, that ad has probably gotten too much coverage at this point. I think it's
now. Do you do the Peloton?
I don't. No. I say it's like an extravagant gift that I would never use. It would sit in my house, and I would collect. I would put like throw my coats on it and stuff like that. That's what it would happen. Realistically, at my house, that's what would happen.
But you're also a very tall person, so I imagine that it's difficult to find. You would have to find the right sized Peloton. I'm sure it's adjustable.
Yeah, probably. But, they probably do all that. It's, yeah. It's got everything. You have
right.
to take your exercise courses on it. And you have to
right.
pay
There's
extra
somebody,
for that.
Somebody yelling at you on screen to push you forward. I don't need that in my life.
Well, it's probably motivational if you use it. But I just, that's not my thing.
Okay, I have one. Oh, I love it.
Okay. And you're
really?
One of the fittest people I know, Kim.
I probably spend 2 or 3 times a week at least.
See, I think it's for fit people. I think fit people that are already fit use the Peloton.
There's classes for all levels.
I don't believe you.
Did you get it as a gift, Kim?
I actually asked for it for my birthday.
So you were just, you're that girl in the ad. Yeah, I mean, like, you were, like, thrilled about
it. Excited.
So you don't understand, I bet, this backlash about...
No, I think it's silly.
Yeah, I do, too.
I agree. I think it's silly, too. Woman looks amazing.
She does, and she likes it, then she likes it. So there you go. Other people read it other ways. The drunkest cities in America, you'll want to hear this one, too. Four of the top five are in Wisconsin. Number one, Green Bay. Number two, Eau Claire. Number three, Appleton. Number four, Madison. Kind of makes sense, a college town, but also...
This also makes sense because there's a lot of cheese curds, fried cheese curds.
It goes with beer.
And that, you need something alcoholic to wash that down.
Do you ever go to the supper clubs, Kim? I know you're from the Wisconsin area.
Yeah, well, my husband is. And you know we're a huge Packer fan, so that does not surprise me at all.
You see a little drinking in the tailgate?
A little bit going on. Keeps you warm in the winter.
Oh, sure. So they looked at cities across the U.S., polled adults, and they were who reported binge or heavy drinking over the last 30 days. By the way, Wisconsin makes an appearance at other numbers within the top 10 as well, so they're heavily represented. I didn't see an Illinois one in the top 20, which is maybe surprising, but a lot of them in the Midwest. Fargo,
right.
North Dakota... Oshkosh is
we have to do something to stay warm, but you should always drink responsibly.
You should, but that's not what everyone's doing, apparently, because they're reporting they're binge drinking. A New Jersey bill, here's another one, trending stories, require school children to be taught cursive handwriting. It's kind of a dying thing. They don't always teach the cursive writing. It's making a comeback in classrooms in some states, but not everywhere.
I remember learning cursive, and... The truth is, as an adult, you end up doing a hybrid cursive print sort of thing anyway.
Yeah, you kind of do. It's kind of hard to read most people's cursive, though, wouldn't you agree? If you wrote like a letter entirely in cursive, you're sort of reading every other word, you know?
Because mine is now part print, part cursive. It's hard to tell.
We've got a lot of people weighing in again, saying nothing wrong with the Peloton ad. I don't know what the big deal is. Ridiculous, the scrutiny of all this. And the gin company is owned, by the way, by Ryan Reynolds. So the actor, Ryan Reynolds, knowing it's about humor, it is actually the actor being portrayed. So check out his Instagram. He's got his own gin company, and he thought that was a way to weigh in as well. We have got to take a break here, and then we'll be back with more. And then Rokan is coming back fresh off of his Carnival Express experience. It was a huge hit, raised a lot for Toys for Tots. And we'll hear from more from him coming up here in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. The news is also coming up on WGN Radio.